In our new series, World War II's Greatest Battles, we chart five pivotal moments that shaped the course of the conflict with military historian James Holland. New episodes drop every Thursday on the History Extra podcast.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Today, healthier is happening at CVS Health in more ways than you've ever seen. It's wellness destinations for seniors, including select locations with Oak Street Health and CVS Pharmacy. It's doctors, nurses, pharmacists, and everyone in between, offering quality care and support virtually, in person, and on the phone. It's in-home evaluations through Signify Health and meeting mental health needs through Aetna. And those are just a few of the ways healthier is happening. To see more, visit cvshealth.com/healthierhappenstogether. CVS Pharmacy, Oak Street Health, CVS Specialty, Signify Health, and Aetna are part of CVS Health. Eligibility and services vary by location and individual.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
Hello and welcome back to this special History Extra End of Roman Britain podcast series. This is episode 6 and I am David Musgrove. This time around I'm talking to Professor Robin Fleming of Boston College, Massachusetts. Robin is a historian, so she's coming at the topic from a slightly different angle from some of our previous guests who are archaeologists. However, her recent book, The Material Fall of Roman Britain, which was published in 2021, looks very much at the archaeological evidence, so I was super keen to chat to her. I dive straight in and ask Robin where she stands on the question of whether there was a collapse at the start of the 5th century.
Yes and no. I mean, things did change. I think there is certainly a collapse of material culture that happens at the tail end of the 4th century and the early 5th century. We don't quite know when it happens because our dating isn't fine-tuned enough. So, for example, there's a bunch of late pottery, and that late pottery from the Roman period is often pushed into the Roman period if it's because there's no way of actually really determining if it was made in 400 or 415 or 420. And so it's very difficult to know when a kind of material culture collapse happened. It happened sometime in the very late 4th, early 5th centuries. And so if you think about the fact that there's this collapse in material culture, what that means is that people who depended on that material culture have to live lives very differently. So if all of your pottery, for example, or the people who have supplied you with pottery are no longer producing pottery, you have to figure out go-arounds about how you're going to live your life. And so I think it's useful to think of the collapse of these productive systems that stood behind the making of so much material culture in the Roman period. But we can look at that collapse, I think, incorrectly in thinking that because the material culture of the Roman period disappears because the manufacturing techniques disappear and the people who were manufacturing are no longer making things the way they had been, it's easy to think that all the new style material culture that is coming in is the result of immigrants who are bringing new style material culture in with them. And so there's, I think the temptation is to see the material culture collapse, not as a material culture collapse, but as the kind of disappearance of everything that went before. And then everything that comes in that's new is a product of the immigrants who are coming from, you know, Germanic speaking lands on the continent.
Let's just stop a moment because That's a view that Robin's given there that echoes what we've already heard in this podcast series, that we need to be mindful of conflating what seems to be undeniable changes in material culture. That's the stuff that archaeologists have been able to dig up and categorise with direct changes in the people who made or used those materials. That seems important, so I wanted to delve into this a bit more. So I asked Robin what changes she does see in culture and society from life in late Roman Britain in, say, 350 AD and 100 years later in post-Roman Britain in 450.
I think that the Roman Empire is experiencing a number of difficulties in the middle of the 4th century. But in Britain, things are pretty okay in the middle of the 4th century. There's lots of evidence for people living in very fancy villas. Towns aren't as big as they had been in the 2nd century, but they're thriving. Local production of very Roman-looking material culture, like pottery, is strong, and it's clear that lots of different kinds of goods are moving across Britain. It's also clear that Britain is really very productive agriculturally, and it does seem as if the kind of agricultural wealth of Britain is being tapped by the Roman Empire, and a lot of that wealth is being brought onto the continent, used to feed the armies of the late Roman Empire who are fighting along the northwestern frontier. So it seems that things are going quite well, but things start going not very well quite rapidly after 350 or so. And so by the time we get to the 380s or so, there's a lot of evidence for certain site types that are actually in distress or changing in quite a lot of interesting ways. So, for example, many Roman villa sites begin to be turning from sites in which elites display their wealth and entertain their friends into kind of production sites. And we find that the great rooms of many villas are being turned into centers of production. So there are corn drying ovens being put in the floors of Roman villas. It looks like livestock is being sort of brought in and sheltered in some of these villas. And so these villa sites look like the people who are in control of them are now sort of worried about producing things, and they're bringing that production sort of closer to home. And they're no longer using these very fancy buildings the way they'd once been used as kind of sites of grand Roman living. And so that's a sign that there's something amiss in Britain, I think, and something seems to be going wrong a little bit with the economy. There are also indications that some of the centers of pottery production are, for example, slowing down. Not all of them are, but some of them are. And they're after 380 or so, it does seem like there's less coin loss. There's still some sites that where you can see that a lot of coins are being used and passed on, but other places less so. And so it does look as if sometime in the 380s, 390s, things get very tough in Britain. And then around some in the years just after 400, it seems as if the Roman state withdraws from Britain, and no longer it's not going to do what the state used to do, which is collect taxes. And the way the Roman state collected taxes was through tax in kind. And so many of the big productive centers and villas and many of the Roman elites were, their prosperity depended on producing for the Roman state. And so when the Roman state withdraws, it looks as if the Roman economy really unwinds pretty rapidly. So if you get to 450, you're in a very different Britain. The towns are dead. The villas are dead. There's been a lot of settlement shift. Many of the late Roman cemeteries where people had buried for a long time and many people had buried are no longer being used as burial sites. And so, and there's no, doesn't look like there's mass production of pottery anymore. There's no coin use. So things look dramatically different. And so something happens in a 40, 50, 60 year period that makes England look very different in 450 than it did in 350. And there would be many historians who would say it's because the invasions came, the Hengist and Horsa and the Anglo-Saxons came. But it looks like the place was pretty ramshackle and knocked down before many people started coming in from the continent.
Let's take a quick pause there because, again, we've got a crucial point. It's not a collapse at the start of the 5th century, but a process of change that's been going on for a while and which perhaps speeds up as we move beyond this moment of political change that we've talked about as the Roman state withdraws and people are less able to rely on it for support and less obliged to provide labour and materials to support it. This tallies with what our other experts have said, but we've also heard that the actual response to this changing political station was different depending on where you were in late Roman or post-Roman Britain. So I asked Robin for her view on that.
It was very different, and in the 5th century in particular, because there are many pieces of Roman culture that survive in the western part of Britain. Christianity, Latinity, elite families, they all seem to weather the late 4th and early 5th centuries in places in Roman Britain that were less tied into the late Roman imperial economy than lowland Britain. And so places like that have quite different histories in the 5th century than lowland Britain, which is going to become England. So I think it's very hard to talk about all of Britain in the 5th century as if you're talking about a single unit.
You've also mentioned elites a couple of times, and in your book, your chapter titles, I think, is The Haves and the Have-Nots. Presumably there is a very different experience between someone who's at the top of the tree in the late Roman period and someone who's at the bottom of the tree as to how changes affect them as we move into the 5th century, as you've described.
Right. So I think if you're dependent in some way on the Roman state, so if you're a member of the elite whose power and prestige in some way depends on the Roman state and your maintenance of it depends on the Roman state, if you're an imperial administrator, if you're a potter whose goods piggyback onto the kind of transportation systems that are used by this Roman state, if you live in a town which is more dependent on the Roman state than not living in a town, the collapse of the Roman economy and the withdrawal of the Roman state, I think, are very, very hard on you. If you're down on the farm and you have been, your labor has been taken from you by your landlord and you pay rents and you pay taxes to the Roman state, are you sorry that the Roman economy is unwound and the state is withdrawn? I'm not so sure. I mean, I think it depends on your local circumstances. If some little local elite family manages to maintain control and keep bullying you out of your produce and your rents, then things might not change. But I think for a lot of people, when you remove the state and you remove the power of elites, there's evidence that for some people, the fall of Rome was a good thing, not a bad thing.
It's an interesting point that just occurs to me from your answer. Would there have been anyone in Roman Britain who wouldn't have noticed the end of Roman Britain?
That's a good question. I mean, I think there are some forms of Roman material culture that are so ubiquitous that it looks as if the kind of long arm of Roman culture and Roman material culture in particular really reaches down pretty far. So, for example, you find hobnail shoes on all kinds of sites. Those are a Roman introduction. They're really good in Britain because, you know, people slip in the mud and it's nice to have shoes with grip on them. The kinds of mass-produced pots that you find are very widespread in Britain. So I think people would have noticed those things disappearing and notice that they have to make do with new kinds of material culture, make things on their own, cook differently because the pots they can make by hand don't operate the way kiln-fired pots do. And most people probably paid taxes and rents. And so I think you would notice if those disappeared. I mean, there could be corners, but I think most people would have noticed that things were changing.
One of your big lines of attack to understand this is to take a proper look at the economic impacts of what happened with the breakup of the Roman network, I guess, isn't it? And what that meant for people's daily lives. Because as you say, if you're not having to pay tax or you're not having to produce a surplus, then your lived experience becomes very different. Is that the right line?
I think that is the right line. And if you, I mean, you think about what most farmers in the world left to their own devices want, is they want to be subsistence farmers. And by subsistence doesn't mean barely having enough. It means having enough and a little more. And What farmers like to do is they like to raise a variety of crops to buffer any kind of risk that might come up. So if the oats don't work, maybe the wheat will work. If the cattle have a problem that year, maybe your sheep will have a problem, won't have a problem. And so it's a way of ensuring that you get by year to year with enough. And what the Roman state and Roman elites wanted was they wanted specialty agriculture. They wanted big grain and they wanted big cattle because that's what the Roman state worked on. And so farmers being able to revert back to a more subsistence, multi-cropping regime with different kinds of, you know, some pastoral work, some crop raising, it's just going to be better for them.
So let's take a moment again, because once more, this takes us back to the narrative that James Gerard referred to in a previous episode, that the disconnect with the wider Roman political and economic network was clearly disruptive and problematic for some, but also perhaps beneficial in a way for others, in the sense that it released the have-nots from some of the onerous obligations that they were required to fulfill. I wanted to know from Robin how that picture was actually evidenced in the archaeology, particularly in terms of corn dryers, which is something that she talks about in her book.
Well, yeah, I mean, corn dryers is one of the, yeah, corn dryers and mills, right? I mean, these are two very prominent features in the Roman period. And there are also above ground grain storage facilities that are found not only in Britain, but they're found across the Roman Empire because big grain is being grown and big grain is being moved and big grain is being stored. And once we move into the very late 4th and early 5th centuries, a lot of these very ubiquitous features disappear. As I might add, do rats in Britain, because rats are big grain storage animals. And a lot of the grain paths seem to disappear as well. And so it does seem that people aren't growing, they aren't participating in this big grain agriculture the way they used to do. So they're doing something else, right? They're not, instead of having to grow a bunch of wheat so that you can give part to the Roman state, you might be able to relax a little and grow some rye or some oats or whatever. And you're not, you're not paying it out. There's not much of a market for it, but you're living a better life because you can buffer against risk.
One of the points you make in your book is that it's not, we have a view in the Western world that subsistence agriculture is not good, but that's not necessarily the case, is it?
Right. Well, the market economy is pretty tough on farmers, actually, particularly in farmers in the developing world. And I think that we have evidence in our own world of what that market economy can do to small-scale farmers. And so we should take that to heart when we think about what it's doing to small-scale farmers in the Roman period as well. There are sites where it does look like people are eating a lot of meat. There's a little bit of bioarchaeology that suggests that people are living longer in the early Middle Ages than they did, or ordinary people, than they did in the early medieval period. And there are lots of reasons for that. I mean, one might simply be that they're not living in urban communities, and urban communities are very hard on the health of their populations. But it might be because they're actually better nourished and better fed, because they're no longer having to pay so much out to landlords and to the state.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
And you mentioned urban communities there, and you mentioned it earlier in the interview as well. Should we imagine that the towns and cities of Roman Britain very rapidly become wastelands, or is that a bit of a wild statement?
I mean, you think about places in the United States that have deindustrialized, places like Detroit, where there are whole elaborate neighborhoods and movie palaces and things that have just fallen into ruin at this point. And that didn't take very long. That took 30 or 40 years. Did it happen fast enough that people would notice it? I mean, if people live 30 or 40 years, if they've got a nice long life in this period of the 4th and 5th centuries, would they have noticed how bad things were getting or not? I mean, is it something? I think it might have been slow enough that you just saw that things were falling apart without things just imploding.
And on that, in your sort of trawl of the evidence that we have, how much evidence do you see of people actively trying to maintain a Roman way of life, or something that was actively pursued in the later 4th century?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there are lots of communities that are trying to hold on. I think it's easier to see in the West, where many sort of Roman cultural practices persisted. So if you look at some of the hill forts that are being repopulated in the west of Britain during this period, there are clearly elites in control. There are clearly elites whose tastes, or at least the tastes of their parents and grandparents, had been set by the Roman Empire, who are still maintaining things like, it looks like, perhaps Roman dining practices as best they can, and particular kinds of elite lifestyle are being maintained. In other communities, there are indications that people are trying very hard to carry on burial practices that had been important to their parents and grandparents. So we see, for example, the use, reuse, maybe scavenging of Roman pottery to use in post-Roman graves, for example, post-Roman funerals. So different people are trying to kind of carry on Roman ways or bits and pieces of Roman ways in different ways within Britain.
So what we're hearing here is we've got some people actively trying to maintain elements of the Roman lifestyle, particularly people who we might describe as elites. And that's an echo of what we talked about with those mosaics at Chedworth Roman Villa in the first episode. But we've also heard about the loss of specific sorts of material culture. And this is a big part of Robin's research, to look at the associated skills that disappeared and the new ones that might have developed in the 5th century. I asked her to give us a little bit more about that.
I think there's both a massive de-skilling and a massive reskilling in this period. It's a little bit like the pandemic, where we all ended up going home and learning how to cook because restaurants weren't open anymore. So I think that a lot of the kind of Roman-style material culture that disappears, people have to learn how to make it on their own, right? So there's lots of indications now that there's a lot of household potting going on in the early medieval period. Right? That's not something that had happened in the Roman period. And so people are learning how to make for themselves. But in terms of the de-skilling, I think the problem is really that because the late Roman economy is starting to fall apart, there is all sorts of specialist labor that works together. And as bits and pieces of that specialist labor disappears because the economy is falling apart and there's no way for those people to make a living anymore, you find that kind of whole categories of material culture disappear. So, for example, if you think about potting, it's not just potters who are making potting possible in the Roman period. There are charcoal makers, there are kiln builders, there are teamsters who are hauling this pottery around. And if any one group of labor specialists who work together to make pottery and move pottery around Britain disappear, then there's a possibility that other people within that chain of production are also going to lose their ability to make a living as well. And so we see whole constellations of material culture going away. And we can see this in the building trades, for example. So there are lots of people who are involved in the building of fancy Roman buildings. But as different skilled workers disappear, you find that people are no longer able to put up Roman-style buildings anymore, because maybe you don't have any roofers in your neighborhood, or you don't have anybody who really knows how to make mortar anymore. So it's really about these kind of constellations of skilled workers that start unraveling, I think, is the problem.
Let's take one more quick pause. We've talked a fair bit about the experience of people who were already living in Britain as the influence of the Roman Empire waned. What we haven't given much attention to is the other big aspect of the 5th century conversation, namely the small matter of migration of people. I wanted to know what Robin's take on this is, specifically whether she thinks there is, in fact, a significant movement of population during this period.
Again, I think it depends on where you are and when you are, and it also depends on who's moving. So, for example, in the west of Britain, where things Romans survive a little better because people weren't as tied into the late Roman economy. There's a lot of incoming people in the west of Britain. They just happen to be coming from Ireland, for example. And I think we need to put those people who are coming in from the west in conversation with the people who are coming in from the east as well. So I think we have to think more holistically about migration in this period as not just a Germanic event, right? There's lots of people on the move in this period, and not all of them are going to, you know, turn into Anglo-Saxons when they grow up. The other thing is, I think that if, you know, again, we need much better radiocarbon dating and we need a lot more isotope work. But it looks like people are starting to come in from the continent, maybe in 425 or so, but not very many. It's the real event. And when we can really see evidence for more people coming in is really at the tail end of the 5th century and the early 6th century. So it's the whole place is collapsed before these people come. They don't knock anything down, right? They it's already, whatever used to be there isn't there anymore. And people, I think, start coming in at a trickle, and then I think they come in at a greater pace. But I also think that when we think about migration in this period of the 5th and 6th centuries, besides thinking about what it looked like in 400 and what it looked like in 600, and it's going to look different, I think we also have to put that in conversation with what migration looked like in the Roman period. Because lots and lots of people were on the move in the Roman period as well. And I think we need to, again, it's about putting these two periods together and looking at kind of waves of migration, who's migrating, why they're migrating across the whole of the 4th, 5th, and 6th centuries. And I think we'd get a different picture of whether what's happening in the early Middle Ages is totally unique and unprecedented, or it's just part of a longer story.
Sure. So it's not specifically a new thing. It's, you know, people moving around, as you say. The Roman Empire is famous for people moving around, isn't it?
Yeah, and people have been moving since the Neolithic, right? So there's a lot of people have been on the move for a long time, and that, you know, in the early Middle Ages, there is a lot of migration, but there's a lot of migration in the 13th and 14th and 15th centuries as well into Britain. So there's a very long story of migration in Britain.
How far does the archaeological evidence and the scientific evidence that we know of at the moment agree or disagree with that historical story that is told by the later sources of these incoming Germanic mercenaries, I guess, invited to help out the poor old Romano-British population? Is that completely thrown out of the water now?
I think it depends on who you ask. I mean, I think the problem with the scientific evidence at the moment, well, I think there's a bunch of problems with the scientific evidence at the moment. One is that there's not enough of it. We need to do, you know, 5 examples or 15 examples do not tell the whole story of the 4th, 5th, 6th, and 7th centuries, right? So we just need a lot more work to be done on this before we have some idea about what the numbers are telling us. People, not just historians, but archaeologists also need to know more about what the science is actually telling us and what the science can tell us. It's very important, I think, for scientists and historians and archaeologists to work together on this, because scientists know a lot about ADNA and they know a lot about isotopes, but they don't know anything about the context of the period that they're talking about. And so I think it's really important for people to work together on this, because at the moment, there's all of this new evidence. There are all of these new techniques. And every side is able to use exactly that same evidence to argue their point. So clearly something is wrong here. You know, it's just, you can take that evidence and you can kind of apply it to whatever argument you want. There's going to be a conference this summer on migration and the early Middle Ages, which I think will be very, very helpful, because I think a lot of people will be coming together to kind of have a sit down and think about how you actually use the evidence to see the period in a fresh way rather than fighting battles that people have been fighting for the last 150 years.
We'd better just take a quick moment because Robin has just mentioned ADNA, ancient DNA, and isotope analysis. So if you're scratching your head about what they mean and how that fits in the story, then fear not. I have the experts lined up in the next couple of episodes to explore and explain those scientific techniques and tell us what they can actually tell us about the picture that we're looking at. There is, I think, a general, though not universal, consensus that there is, or was, a reasonable amount of movement of people in the 5th century, not just from the continent, but also from the West. So what's the dynamic between those incomers and those who are already here? Back to Robin.
I think that it's very difficult to tell, because how do you know who's who? I mean, unless you're lucky enough to find people who have very strong indications in their strontium and oxygen isotopes that they have moved from someplace else. Everybody is using the same material culture. They're wearing the same brooches. They're wearing the same clothes. They're using the same pots. So how do you tell somebody whose grandfather was born in Britain from somebody whose grandfather was born in the lowlands? You can't. And as a matter of fact, using isotopes, you probably can't tell the difference either. And using ADNA, you probably can't tell the difference. Because those populations have a lot to do with one another and they're living on similar hard geology. So, I mean, definitive answers are very hard to find.
So as I've mentioned, we've got much more coming up on the new science and how it's adding an extra dimension to the story. Though, as Robin warns, and I think everyone involved in the subject is aware, all researchers need to get their heads around what it's telling us and indeed get their heads together to properly understand it. You'll remember, hopefully, that James Gerard in the last episode talked about how people might have been actively reimagining who they were and their cultural identities. And it's one of the things that is definitely coming through in these conversations, I think, the fact that it's really, really difficult to establish what people might have considered their identity or their ethnicity from the material culture and physical remains that survive, and the scientific techniques that we can employ on them. In fact, this whole question of ethnicity is probably one of the most intractable issues, and perhaps really something that we're much more hung about now than anyone alive in the 5th century really was.
I think the ethnicity of these people is much more important to us than it was to them. And I think that the way ethnicity works, did people have an ethnicity in the 5th century? I'm not so sure. I think that once elites start reforming in Britain, it becomes very important for them to differentiate themselves in some ways. And I think the kinds of ethnic markers that might actually be ethnic markers begin to develop in that period. And I think that they then use ethnicity as a kind of tool in order to shore up their own power and to differentiate themselves from others. But whether people down on the farm had ethnicity is an entirely different question. And when you ask if somebody in the 5th century was British or from British ancestry, if somebody was from Anglo-Saxon ancestry, would anybody have known or cared? It's very hard to know the answer to that. I think that we care about it a lot. But I also care a lot about the term Anglo-Saxon, and there's quite a difference between whether it's felt to use that term is proper or not. It's different in North America than it is in Britain generally, although there are people in Britain who I think share my belief that it's a term that should be lit on fire, torn up, and never used again. And my reasons for not liking the term very much have to do with, in part, the kind of history of that term, right? There's evidence that people used the term Anglo-Saxon in the pre-conquest period, but it happens much later than the 5th and 6th and 7th centuries. It's just not a term that people used then. And nobody came over in a little boat from the continent to England in the 5th or 6th centuries and stepped ashore and said, "I'm an Anglo-Saxon," because there was no such thing as an Anglo-Saxon. It's a kind of hodgepodge invention, and it was not an identity in that period. And the trouble with continuing to use that term, even if we all say we know better and we don't really mean what people think we mean when we say Anglo-Saxon, is that when you talk to regular people think when you use the word Anglo-Saxon, you mean Anglo-Saxon. So when you talk about an Anglo-Saxon pot, who made the Anglo-Saxon pot? Well, Anglo-Saxons made the Anglo-Saxon pot. So suddenly you're telling people who aren't necessarily trained in the field that the people who you don't really believe in are responsible for everything and making everything in this period. I mean, it's a terrible term. It's so misleading. It should be thrown away. And then there's the problem of the white nationalists and actually believing that, you know, white people conquered England and are going to save the world. And that's a problem too.
You make a very good argument there. I wonder if we got in a time machine and went back to 5th century Britain, we're wandering around and we're sort of pointing at people and said, so what are you? Are you English, Romano, British, Anglo-Saxon? What people say? Would they say, I'm none of those things. I belong to this group, this city, this tribe? What would people say, do you imagine?
I think in the early 5th century, they're most likely to say, well, I live in this place and these are my family. So your very local area and who you're related to must be important. And I think I'm quite convinced that there's evidence that in the 5th century, there are people of mixed ancestry. There are newcomers and people who've been there for a long time who seem to be making common cause and creating families and living together. So all of these people together are creating whatever is going to come out of the 5th and 6th centuries. So it's not just the newcomers from the continent who are making the English English. It's the people who've been there all along are participating in this. And they're, even though they might have had all their ancestry come from Britain and had lived there since the Iron Age, they're participating in making the English too, which is another reason why Anglo-Saxon is a bad term. It just writes out the indigenous population completely in the story of the making of the early Middle Ages and making of lowland Britain and England.
So this is the process that James Gerard might describe as ethnogenesis.
Many people would describe it as ethnogenesis. But the thing about ethnogenesis is it is not just that cute German girl and that nice local Roman boy making babies together, right? That's not just ethnogenesis. Ethnogenesis is what happens a few generations around when a local bigwig comes around and says, we people like us all wear the same brooch and we speak the same dialect and we eat the same food because we're a people now, right? And so the ethnogenesis requires elites to kind of marshal the kind of culture that's emerging and claim for himself that it's a kind of people and it's a people that he rules.
For the benefit of everybody who hasn't spent years studying this as you have, how do we get from this society which feels quite structured and ordered, the late Roman British society, where we kind of have a sense about what that means, or at least maybe we don't, to this new society, which is markedly different, isn't it? In a couple of centuries later, which has trappings of, I can't think of a better word to use to describe it than Anglo-Saxon. Pull me up on it and say something else, but it's a different way of living.
I would
and
say
existing.
Early medieval.
Sure. Okay.
You don't need to put an ethnic label on it.
No. Okay. So how do we get to how do we move from that one source of society to this quite different source of society?
We're very different from the 19th century, right? We're always different from what happens in the past. But the thing that's different between the 19th century and the 21st century and the period that we're talking about is there is this kind of rapid reconfiguration that has a very marked material component where it does seem like a lot of stuff gets erased and people have to start over in a lot of ways. And I'm thinking here about, you know, there's not very many places in the world where there's been a real material culture collapse. I mean, it happens in Central America under the Mayans, for example. Not that many places where literacy goes away, written language goes away in Britain. And so whatever happens very fast there. And so I think that it's the rapidity that makes the change seem so startling, I think. But living through it, I think if you're living through it and you're living in the last decade of the 4th century, the first couple of decades of the 5th century, you must really feel it Do you feel it in the same way if you're living? Is the late 5th century that different from the early 6th century in a way? Is it changing so rapidly that you would notice it changing? I mean, we can see it changing from the archaeological record, but would people living through that feel it as the same kind of change as happened in the very late 4th, early 5th century? I don't think so. But I do have to say the kind of rapidity of the collapse makes me nervous. Living in end times, as we seem to be, you know, with climate collapse and pandemic and all this stuff, you do realize that things aren't as steady as you think they are. Things aren't as eternal as they seem when you're living in them.
Let's just take one more moment, because we'll come back to whether there are modern parallels to what happened in the 5th century in the final episode of the series. And we'll also dwell a bit more on whether our experts have found their analysis of the period at all influenced by the seismic events that we're living through now as well. But to finish this episode, I just wanted to be clear about whether Robin thinks that the word apocalypse is appropriate at all for the experience of people living through the end of Roman Britain.
I think for some people, I think it was pretty hard. So again, it always depends on who you are and where you are. I mean, look at the pandemic. It's been very, very hard on some people. And a lot of people, a few billionaires, have had a very good ride in the pandemic. So I do think it's situational.
So you've been listening to Professor Robin Fleming of Boston College, Massachusetts, and her book, The Material Fall of Roman Britain, is out now and covers a lot of the ground we've discussed here in far more depth. Next episode, we're going to dive right into the science with a look at what stable isotope analysis can tell us about the population of Britain in the 5th century. Dr. Sam Leggett is going to be our guide, and if science befuddles you, do not fear, because Sam explains it all with crystal clarity.